This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Tax policy is hard. That doesn't mean it has to be confusing, too. We will straighten out some misconceptions this half hour from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, October the 11th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to begin and, in fact, end the program today with official statements from the White House. You'll recall now ex-press secretary Sean Spicer said that if the president tweets something, it is an official statement. So here we go. The president of the United States said this today, quote, "It would be really nice if the fake news media would report the virtually unprecedented stock market growth since the election. Need tax cuts." First of all, we are here for you every single day, sir. But the president also said this, if Congress gives us the massive tax cuts and reform I'm asking for, those numbers will grow by leaps and bounds. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra tried to make all of that make economic sense.
Here's the argument. When companies get a tax cut, that's more money they have left over after paying their tax bill. Eric Irvin is CEO of the exchange-traded fund issuer Reality Shares.
The less they have to pay in taxes, the more earnings they have, and the more valuable that company is to me as an investor or shareholder.
There's also an argument that if you cut taxes on individuals, they'll go shopping, boosting company profits and therefore stocks as well. But historically, the effect of tax cuts on stocks has been hard to measure. Ronnie Micaeli, who teaches finance at Cornell, has studied the market after tax cuts, like the ones by the Bush administration in 2003.
If there is an effect, it's quite small. At least that's what we can learn from the past.
One reason? Investors tend to know a tax cut might be coming well before it happens. In this case, since President Trump was elected. Joe Duran is CEO of the wealth management firm United Capital.
Stocks are already going up in anticipation of that being true. So by the time the tax cut happens, the stock market already has adjusted for that.
But tax cuts aren't a sure thing yet. So Tom Wheelwright, a tax advisor and head of the CPA firm Provision, says we might still see the market go up a bit if they happen. If they don't?
Then, of course, that has a huge negative impact because it's all a confidence game. Right. And you had all this confidence that this was going to happen, and then it didn't.
He says what was priced in would have to get priced out. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
As long as we're on taxes, there is another thing to point out here before we move on. How the president says and then says and then says some more that the United States is the most taxed country in the world. That's not true. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams unpacks the economic confusion.
This question came up in Tuesday's White House press briefing. Here's what White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders had to say about it.
We are the highest taxed corporate tax in the developed economy. That's a fact.
But that's not what the president said.
That's what he's talking about. We are the
okay,
highest
then.
Corporate
Let's
tax.
Let's just look at the corporate tax rate.
The statutory corporate tax rate, which sometimes is referred to as the headline tax rate, is the highest among developed countries.
Drew Lyon is with global accounting firm PwC and advises corporate clients on taxes. Our corporate tax rate is 35%, which just barely tops France.
Now, the next question is, but is that the rate companies actually pay? And the answer is no.
After deductions, exemptions, and loopholes, U.S. businesses often end up at a rate that's lower than other developed countries. John Gimigliano is a principal for tax and audit advisory firm KPMG. He says this is what's called the effective rate.
When you look at the effective tax rate of U.S. companies, on average, it's more the middle of the pack.
Like closer to the mid-20s as opposed to 35%. So while U.S. corporations might technically have the highest tax rate, when it comes to what U.S. companies actually pay, we are not
the highest taxed nation in the world.
In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today. Well, I refer you to the aforementioned Mariel Segarra story on presidential tweets and stock prices with which we began. We will have the details when we do the numbers. You want a big sugary soda today? Cook County, Illinois is the place for you. The county board has repealed a controversial soda tax just 2 months after it went into effect. It's the biggest jurisdiction, Cooks County, to have passed a tax on sugary drinks, which brought with it legal challenges and some serious soda lobbying. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that one.
When Cook County's lead commissioner cast the deciding vote on the soda tax last fall, she cited the revenue it could provide, up to $200 million to help fill a budget gap. But it hasn't come close to that. First, lawsuits delayed the tax by many months. Cook County residents have reportedly just shopped elsewhere to avoid the tax, and outside money has fought to sway public opinion, like this local ad paid for by the American Beverage Association.
I really want to see the beverage tax repealed. I just can't take anymore. This is the last straw. It makes you want to leave.
Public health advocates, including former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, have spent even more money fighting the tax repeal with their own marketing, says Cornell University professor John Cowley.
Chicago is just one battlefield in a national and international war between public health officials and the beverage industry.
This one looks like another win for Big Soda and follows a no vote on a soda tax in Santa Fe, New Mexico earlier this year. Food activist Marion Nessel, author of Soda Politics, says soda taxes are not going away, and they can even be popular when they fund a cause like fighting childhood obesity.
To the extent that cities can organize the tax revenue so that they go for purposes that people want them for, they'll get a lot of support. That didn't happen in Chicago.
Cook County reports 40% of its children are overweight or obese. That's above the national average. The county's soda tax goes away December 1st. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Harris County, Texas, within which lies Greater Houston, has asked FEMA for $17 million to buy up more than 100 homes that have been deemed, and these are their words, hopelessly at risk for future flooding. We are a little more than a month post-Hurricane Harvey now, and the county wants to get these buyouts done as soon as possible so as to avoid the years this process usually takes, except that even when buyouts look like sound policy, they are not easy to get done. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that story from Houston.
Woodland Trails West is a neighborhood in northwest Houston. Its main road dead ends at White Oak Bayou. Its sleepy, slow waterway became a rushing river after Harvey. Benjamin Singer stands on the porch of his family's 1960s ranch house, three homes away from the water. The bayou has consistently flooded here since he was growing up in the 80s.
If you looked over there, that whole flat has been cleared.
Over time, it's become a haphazard landscape, clusters of homes in between vacant lots. He points across the water where other families have taken buyouts.
There's no houses but maybe 20 in that whole neighborhood.
His family's house stayed dry in Harvey, but it has flooded twice in 15 years. The Singers considered a buyout when their house flooded last year, and they got a letter from the county.
We decided to put in an application to see what the FEMA would give us, and if it was something that would be worth our while, we would obviously take it, but we declined.
He won't say how much the family was offered, but says they didn't find the amount worth the price of upending their whole life. They could have appealed to try for a better offer, but they would have had to hire their own appraiser. This time, after Harvey, Harris County plans to push more aggressively to get homeowners like the Singers to move. And Harris County Judge Ed Emmett wants to fast-track the process.
What you don't want is a rebuild, spending all the money to rebuild a home, and then a few months later we come in and say, oh, by the way, we want to buy it and tear it down.
A massive map of Harris County takes up one whole wall of his office. He points out other neighborhoods he's targeting.
Bel Air, West University, Meyerland area, Braes Heights. It's along Braes Bayou. It's repeatedly flooded.
He says he needs $650 million to buy out 3,600 homes in perpetual flood danger countywide. Usually that money comes from FEMA and takes years to get in rounds of negotiations between locals and feds. Alex Greer is a political scientist at Oklahoma State University. He studies homeowner buyouts after disaster. He says right now the process starts from scratch each time.
You know, what we'd expect to see is that some of the general characteristics of buyouts would stay the same, and we iterate over time and make them better. You don't see that.
He wants to see nationwide reform establish some best practices. Yet forcing people to move is often just inherently emotional and messy. I meet Jean Olson leaning against her car outside her little home in a flooded area called Bel Air. All of her belongings are in a pile in the front yard.
Just did not expect the water to get as high as it did. I was 29 inches in my house. And I'm 20 inches off the ground. I'm on pier and beam. So that's 4 feet of water.
She separated out family heirlooms, but she doesn't have anywhere to take them. So she's posted signs. No trespassing. No stealing. Since Olson bought her single-story home in 1993, huge million-dollar houses have sprung up on all sides. Many of those neighbors are living on their second floors while the ground level gets repaired. Some have cooked for Olson and even let her stay with them a night or two. Olson's house flooded twice in the past 20 years, but she's not at all interested in a buyout.
There's no other place in Houston I really want to live. I love my neighbors. I love my neighborhood. You know, it's just, it's home.
That dog won't hunt, she says about a buyout as I leave. Alex Greer at Oklahoma State University says he's seen situations where even the most stubborn homeowners get pressured into taking buyouts.
Officials would tell them, well, if you stay here, you know, we may not bring back in power lines, or you may have to worry about vermin and crime and all those things. So it doesn't feel like an option.
There is a path for Houston to force buyouts. It would have to use strictly local funds, no federal money, and exercise eminent domain, seizing private land for public use. But politicians at every level want to avoid going down that road. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace. Coming up.
And I would throw myself on my bed. I would rip open the magazines and inhale them.
You know, figuratively, but there is a definite passion for print there. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 0.1% today, 42 points, closed at 22,872. NASDAQ picked up 0.2%, 16 points, 6603. The S&P 500 up about 0.1%, 4 points, 2555. Apple is betting that teaming up with Steven Spielberg is going to make for some great original programming. Apple ended up 0.4% today. Comcast, which owns a majority stake in NBC Universal, down 0.7% today. Kroger says it might sell its convenience store business after determining it might have more value outside their brand. Shares of Kroger rang up 1.2% today. Amazon, which owns Whole Foods, cooked up 0.7%. Target rang up about 2.6%. We'll learn this week just how much the big financial institutions are raking in. JP Morgan Chase and Citigroup kick off earnings season tomorrow. JP Morgan Chase off 0.2% today. Bonds up, yields on the 10-year T-note down to 2.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you are confused about what is going on in Spain, join the club. The Catalan regional president said yesterday that basically Catalonia has a right to independence. He wants to talk it over, though. Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy came back today and said,
You got 8 days or else, the or else being the national government possibly taking direct rule. The BBC's Matthew Price went to Catalonia to get the economic mood.
On national radio, the crisis in Catalonia overshadows everything. Driving across the boundary into this restive region, however, and you barely notice it. No flags nor fanfare, just a simple road sign. But here, in the old northern Catalan city of Girona, you do notice. This is the centre of the secessionist movement, and there are pro-independence signs everywhere. Banners in primary colours are hanging high up from the balconies. Two letters on them, S and I. C, yes to independence. In the nearby Catalan taverna, they're playing a Catalan band. Iban Bendrell, the manager, also wears his politics on his sleeve.
Many people from my family fought in the civil war for his rights. And now we are arriving in at that process of independence that they fought for.
The reason I came in is the slogan for your business is "We're fighting for independence." Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of marketing.
Is it successful marketing?
Actually, here in Girona is the part of the country of Catalonia, the most independent. So, yes, it is a good marketing.
Well, I'm just driving into Barcelona now, surrounded by scooters. This is a cosmopolitan city. It's a vibrant city, a confident city. And yet some of the confidence has been knocked out of many of the inhabitants here. Ever since the announcement by the banks, a couple of the banks, that they were moving their headquarters, other companies are thinking of following suit. And there are those in Barcelona that will tell you that any move to declare independence would be an economic disaster for this place.
In a situation of secession, Catalonia will be outside the European Union.
And that's the key point for economist Ferran Brevet, one of the leading anti-independence campaigners. His group was instrumental in organising the counter-demonstrations in Barcelona last weekend.
The Republic of Catalonia, an hypothetical Republic of Catalonia, is no signatory of the treaties establishing the European Union. It will be outside the euro and outside the cover of the European Central Bank.
Now listen to Jordi Soler, a politician from one of the most powerful pro-independence parties.
I would like to hear a declaration of independence in our parliament, in the Catalan parliament, always leaving the door open to dialogue, to implement what independence means in practical terms.
But what does a declaration of independence actually mean? Some in the ruling coalition here say nothing short of seceding from Spain. Others, like Jordi Soler, use the word process. There is potential here for a split in the pro-independence governing coalition. There is also, though, potential for a rupture in the state of Spain that would reverberate across the whole of Europe.
The BBC's Matthew Price in Girona, Catalonia. If you heard our conversation from the corner office last week, you heard me fess up that those interviews with CEOs don't, you know, technically always happen in corner offices. Today, another revelation, I guess you'd call it. The person with whom you're about to hear me talk isn't a CEO, but she is plenty powerful and influential all the same. Joanna Coles is the chief content officer for Hearst Magazines. Esquire, Harper's Bazaar, Good Housekeeping are some of the titles you will know. Coles is fresh off a run as the editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan. I went to see her in her office when I was in New York a couple of weeks ago, and as I started, I did, as I often do with people, asked her to set the scene.
This is the office of the chief content officer of Hearst. It's a rather thrilling office, isn't it? I've got my treadmill desk, which I love, and which I walk on a lot because sitting is the new smoking. We have a view of Central Park, and we also have this magnificent picture of Kim Kardashian at a newsstand, painted from the back, looking at different covers of herself.
It took me a minute. I wasn't going to say anything, but since you brought it up, that's a very Kardashian-esque pose in that portrait.
It is, by which I think you mean she has an enormous ass in her jeans.
I wasn't going to say that, but sure. Is it yours or is it the company's?
It's actually mine.
But
I do, if you want to point out, have a wonderful picture of Bob Dylan walking through Central Park, or actually down Central Park West, by Richard Avedon, which is the company's.
Aha. So you have to give that one back.
Sadly, I have to give that back when they fire me. And I will know that when the head of security refuses to let me through the turnstile where I have to come every day.
This is probably a good moment then, talking about you getting fired, to point out that you've only been in this job like a year or
so. I have. So I'm hoping for a little bit more runway, but you never say never.
Can we back up for a minute before we get to you and magazines and media in New York? You used to be a daily news journalist. I mean, doing daily coverage.
I did.
Tell us the story.
Well, I started at the Daily Telegraph as a daily news reporter. I moved then to The Guardian, and then I moved to New York as the correspondent for The Guardian, moved to The Times of London. And really, it was the best job you could imagine. You could cover any story you wanted in America. So I had a wonderful time traveling all over America. And actually, it turned out to be fantastically good training for navigating today's media landscape, which changes every day. And anybody who tells you where it's going to be in a year is lying, because nobody knows.
You get a job at Marie Claire. You then get the job running Cosmo. You take those two magazines and you, with no offense to anybody who came before you, you put them back on the landscape.
Well, thank you.
Is there a secret? Is there a trick? Because you've done it twice now, and here you are running magazines for Hearst. What's the secret sauce?
There is no secret sauce apart from deep passion for women's journalism, which is always underestimated and often overlooked. And I was lucky enough, I think, to coincide with this new feminism and this new awareness that women weren't getting on as fast as they should have been. I mean, there were more women going to college and yet fewer women in leadership positions. And that didn't make sense. And young women were becoming animated by that, and millennial women were becoming annoyed by that. And I was able to reflect on that in both magazines.
Do you have a responsibility as a woman in a very senior leadership position in a very high-profile company in a culture-changing industry? Do you have a responsibility to other women to mentor them and bring them along?
Well, one of the things that I have been involved in is executive producing a show called The Bold Type, which is on Freeform. And one of the reasons I wanted to do it was to show that women in the workplace frequently support each other. I have never had an unsupportive female boss. I've had several female bosses. They have all been super supportive. I don't like the tropes, particularly in my industry, that the senior women are mean to the junior staff.
Yeah, that does seem to be a stereotype, right?
It's a total stereotype that came out of the Miranda Priestly character in Devil Wears Prada, right, which is, and of course, conflict makes for great drama, but it turned out that the bold type was able to break that trope.
Is this a good time or a difficult time to be running magazines?
It's a challenging time, but it's incredibly exciting. I mean, we recently launched a magazine called Pioneer Woman with Ree Drummond, which has just sold out. We launched a magazine with Airbnb, which I'm thrilled to see you brought in under your arm, which we couldn't be more excited about. There is a whole new generation of traveler that Airbnb discovered that we can produce a magazine for.
Okay, but do those travelers need an Airbnb magazine, or can they just go on their phones and figure out what they need to know?
Well, they're not zero sum. I mean, everybody likes everything, I think. I mean, you're not only getting content from a phone. People get content from television, from magazines, from newsstands, from their friends. And so I think you can be in all places most of the time.
Why did you take this job? Or why did Hearst put you in this job, I guess, might be a better question.
Well, I think Hearst put me in the job because they were hoping that I would be able to come up with some new ideas and take some of the ideas that we have from a lot of people in the building and actually make them happen. And one of the disciplines of being a daily journalist was to always get the story, to actually have a goal in mind and manage to what we called in journalism then, it's a very Daily Mail term, but get the mother, which is where you want to get the mother of the victim or the mother of the criminal. But it's like, can you get to the mother?
Right.
And I'm reasonably good at getting to the mother.
What's the measure of success then, right? Because it can't just be newsstand sales or like ad revenue, right? What's your measurement?
Well, a newsstand sales and ad revenue, why can't that be the measure of success? That seems to me an excellent measure of success. We're in a consumer-led business. If the consumer doesn't want it, if the ad market's not going to support it, it's not working.
What is it about magazines for you?
When I was growing up as a child, a magazine to me was like a finger beckoning me to the future. A magazine editor's job is to imagine what in 3 months, 6 months, a year from now we're going to be thinking about, what we're going to be talking about, what that vision or that voyage of discovery will be. And I would throw myself on my bed, I would rip open the magazines and inhale them and look forward to a more glamorous, sophisticated life, which was what the aspiration of the magazine was.
Have you then created that life for yourself that you saw in the magazines? As we sit here overlooking Central Park with your
nice observation,
desk?
Kai. Huh? I might have done. I might have created part of it for myself.
Joanna Coles, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We talked a good half an hour or so, Joanna Coles and I. Hear the rest of it on our Corner Office podcast, available wherever you choose to get your podcasts.
This final note on the way out today. As promised, we end with an official statement from the President of the United States. This morning, upset at some reportage by NBC, Mr. Trump said this, quote, "With all of the fake news coming out of NBC and the networks, at what point is it appropriate to challenge their license?" End quote. The technical answer is never. I cite here the Federal Communications Commission itself, which says, quote, "The First Amendment protects broadcasts that criticize or ridicule established customs and institutions, including the government and its officials. However," it goes on, "if you are offended by a station's programming, we urge you to make your concerns known to the station licensee in writing." All right, we got to go Wall Street up a tetch all the way around. Yes, that is the technical market term. Sarah Bruguiere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Talladay engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.